You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Street Roots digital producer Kanani Cortez about this week's issue of the paper, The Spring Anthology, Volume 1. Welcome to the show, Kanani.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk with me. So we're looking at the Spring Anthology issue, Volume 1 today. For folks who don't know, what's that all about?
Yeah, so the Spring Anthology issues are two issues that we publish every spring. I believe now this is the third year in a row. And what it is a kind of overview of the last 12 months of reporting. And so we take a look back and we republish some of what we consider, you know, our best works or most impactful or just things that we think that readers will find worth revisiting, or if you're a new reader that maybe you missed it the first time around. So it's an opportunity for folks to kind of revisit work we've done that maybe it's changed over time, like the news itself, but the story and the information is still relevant. And this also lines up with our spring fund drive. So it's also a opportunity for us to kind of just take a look at the work the newsroom does and how supporting Street Roots, supporting our newsroom, really helps us produce this journalism that people read every week.
Very cool. So why don't we go through and kind of give an overview of some of the stories that are in this anthology this week? The first one is In the Name of Safety. This is from Street Roots correspondent Piper McDaniel. Records suggest Commissioner Rene Gonzalez halted tent distribution to align with mayor's camping ban, despite claims it was due to an uptick in fires. Can you talk me through that one?
Yeah, so this was a really important piece that we published in August of last year. And specifically, you know, this was in the same time that we're looking at the mayor's camping ban and a lot of conversations that are happening around housing and homelessness. You know, as usual, I think in the realm of what we cover, and this was specifically about Rene Gonzalez had halted tent distribution from Portland Street Response at the time, and Portland Street Response operating under the fire department. And so that was obviously a huge blow, and people are really concerned about people's safety without, you know, even the shelter of a tent when they're sleeping outside. And so Piper had gone and, you know, dug through some records, and really what she was seeing was that, you know, Gonzalez had said that this was due to an uptick in fires, but some of the records really suggested otherwise, and the timing with the camping ban was saying a lot. So I think that this is another piece that I really appreciate, because I think that Street Roots really hopes to accomplish in our reporting and our investigative reporting specifically are, you know, what is happening behind the scenes and why are we seeing these policies and the timing of them as well as the impact. And so I thought this was really illuminating for readers, especially as the news cycle is moving so fast and there's obviously so many voices around this issue. And so I thought that this was a great story that kind of broke down some of the decision making we were seeing.
Right. And also in this spring anthology is the story that Street Roots correspondent Aurora Biggers did on the Magic Tavern dancers who were striking. Strippers on Strike is the title of that article, trying to become the second unionized club in the United States.
Yeah. So as you said, Aurora had covered this in June of last year. And Aurora at the time was doing a lot of labor coverage and also does our monthly labor column and kind of in review of what is happening in the Oregon labor scene. And so this was a really important story. Like you said, that they would have been the second unionized strip club in the U.S. And so there's some great photos here that I believe are by Allison Barr, who went to one of the pickets that month and kind of got a feel for just what is happening in this community and like what, you know, workplace safety and things are needed by these workers. But also I think bringing light to an issue that I would say a lot of union organizers and laborers and workers agree with is that like no matter the workplace, whether it be, you know, automotive, you're working in an office or you're working in a strip club, like there is still the same need for workers' rights and workplace safety. And so I think that this was a great story that highlighted some of that. And, you know, I think that people agree Portland definitely is a union town in a lot of ways. And I think Aurora does a great job of keeping up with, yeah, what is happening and how that's of interest to our readers.
I spoke with Aurora when this article came out. Here's what she said then.
Magic Tavern opened back in November 2022, and pretty quickly after that, dancers say that they realized that there were a lot of significant security and safety issues in the club. Chiefly, workers were concerned that when the club opened, there weren't any cameras inside, and it's an industry standard to have cameras inside the club, so that was something that workers were immediately concerned about. There are now cameras inside the club currently, but they're not all in all the places dancers feel that they need to be. There was also a concern around security. The club, when it opened, had one security guard. That security guard, though, often also worked as the DJ or the cook. When talking to some of the dancers, you know, one said, how can you be protecting your girls when you're making a burger? So those are some of the main concerns that they had, as well as other behaviors from management that workers did not feel were appropriate in the workplace. But security concerns are definitely the main thing that they are trying to address through their current campaign. You know, when they went on strike a few days before they actually decided to start working with the union, which is Actors Equity. And at that time, they were going on strike because they wanted to demand a few different things from the club, including an official contract with the club. They also wanted to have a dedicated booking manager, an appropriate amount of adequately trained security, and they also wanted some physical safety issues fixed. So when the club opened, the dancers also said that the flooring and the pole weren't properly installed, which is a massive physical safety issue, especially when you're working in 6 to 9 inch heels on a dance floor and, you know, doing athletics. That's something that's not very safe. They're also looking to have a more equitable environment for queer dancers and dancers of color, and we'll also be bringing up things like wages and scheduling as well. I think that it would be great for readers to read the story and be able to consider what misconceptions they've maybe had about the industry or about the labor movement, and whether they see other industries that they would love to see unionized, that they maybe feel that they can see the stigma around those industries and can better understand their own rights as well. I think that this is an article that would be great to read and see that if this is an industry that can unionize, any industry can unionize, and that all work is valid work and should have safety and protections, and every worker has the right to a healthy work environment.
And then this issue also has a reprint of the article, When We Get Together, Things Happen. An exhibit explores contributions of two-spirit indigiqueer people while promoting healing and acceptance. That one's from Melanie Henshaw, Street Roots' Indigenous Affairs reporter.
Yeah, this was a wonderful Q&A with two curators for this exhibit called My Father's Father's Sister. And it was really exploring identity for two-spirit and queer indigenous people, also known as indigiqueer, which they talk a lot about. And I thought this was a great conversation. I definitely recommend you read it if you didn't catch it the first time around. But I think this just goes a lot into how queer identities and two-spirit identities and, you know, are part of indigenous histories. And I think the interviews with the two curators captured that really well. And also just a fun kind of read along about their relationship together and how they came to curate this show together. And a lot of local artists were a part of this. So definitely worth checking it out. There's some beautiful work and photos in this one.
I spoke with Melanie when this article first went to print. Here's a bit of that conversation.
So the exhibit is at the Chichalu Cultural Museum in Grand Ronde, as you mentioned, and it's centered around a 19th century two-spirit Otfaladi Kalapuya healer named Shumgin. Shumgin was very well-liked and respected within her community and was accepted for her gender nonconformity, and even though she would be what's today is described as trans feminine, that didn't limit her or cause her to face any limitations prior to colonization. And The exhibit highlights Shumgin, that history, as well as the contributions and profiles of several contemporary Two-Spirit individuals within the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde. There's no one definition of Two-Spirit or Indigenous-queer. There are hundreds and hundreds of tribes across Turtle Island that are evidenced to have had some degree of gender diversity or gender nonconformity. Two-Spirit is a term that kind of encapsulates that. And there's evidence that prior to contact with white Christian settlers, that this was more widely accepted as normal and as a feature of the community. But after contact with Christian settlers, that this became increasingly othered and increasingly marginalized. And that marginalization has unfortunately made its way into Native communities as well. So I think for the co-curators, it was important to show not only people outside of their community, but people inside the community as well, that they have a long history of existing within their culture, and that this existence of Shumgin and her presence in historical documents is proof of that gender diversity and that existence prior to colonization, at least in this particular context with regards to Otfalati, Kalapuya people, and the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde.
And then Melanie also reported in June of last year on the Supreme Court decision to uphold ICWA, the Indian Child Welfare Act. This was a very informative article.
Yeah, I think that Melanie did such a great job. I think that with a lot of Indigenous affairs reporting, and if you're writing for, you know, a non-Indigenous audience, there is a lot of work of providing so much context for people who are like, oh, I don't know anything about these communities. I don't know anything about tribal laws. And I think Melanie navigates that really well with, you know, we have this story in and of itself about the Supreme Court, about ICWA, and then also a greater context and history for people who are maybe learning about this for the first time. And this is a really important story. Like you said, the Supreme Court upheld the Indian Child Welfare Act. And yeah, this was a very important issue and definitely widely talked about. And I think the decision had been, she had written that it was being waited on for about 6 months. What ICWA does is it prioritized placement for Native and Indigenous adoptees or children to be also placed with an adoptive family or a foster care family who's also Native. And I think that she really ties in how this plays into tribal sovereignty and, yeah, the kind of want for Native nations to protect their youth and make sure that their youth are within their communities, regardless of their status as a foster child or anything of that nature. So definitely worth a read. I think, like you said, very informative. And I think that this is kind of something that we see the news, right? Like this, you know, you get this big news and it feels like it comes and goes. But I think that this is a great example, like many other news pieces, of, you know, something that this information is something to hold on to. We see so many cases and longstanding things come back to the Supreme Court and we're revisiting issues. And we see the same thing with Roe v. Wade. And what that meant and the repercussions of that. And so I think that kind of this continuous learning about these policies or acts that exist in our everyday lives is really important for when we're seeing changes being made for better or for worse.
What do you hope readers get from this issue of the paper?
I definitely hope that readers, new or old, either can revisit or share something that they've read before and share it with a friend, or if you missed it the first time, I love that, you know, the news is still relevant. I think working in a 24-hour news cycle, it's very go, 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 or this is no longer relevant, or, you know, we don't want to print this. Nobody cares about this anymore. And it's such a fast-paced news cycle. But I think something like the Spring Anthology kind of allows us to revisit things and remember that You know, I'd argue that's not true, right? Like, there is so much information that is coming at us, but we're still seeing the repercussions of all of this decision making and this union organizing or this arts exhibit and conversations that are happening across so many different communities. So I just hope that, yeah, readers can be reminded of the relevance of these issues, or if it's their first time reading it, then hopefully they learn something new.
Where can folks find a copy for themselves?
So as always, you can find a copy of Street Roots from a Street Roots vendor near you. You should definitely do that. And you can also find all of our stories online at streetroots.org, or you can find us on social media at Street Roots on all platforms.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Yeah, I think just that the spring anthology is awesome. So look out for the next one after this as well. We also have a vendor issue coming up this month. And this is also along with our spring fund drive, as I mentioned. And I think that when I look back at these stories, it really is a reflection of the work that our journalists, our editorial team, our organization is able to do. And, you know, producing local investigative journalism, which is very much supported and funded by our readers. And so, yeah, if you're interested in supporting this great work in our journalism, you're really contributing to the paper that we get to make every week.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk me through it.
Thank you so much. I'll see you next time.
All right. That was Street Roots digital producer Kanani Cortez speaking with me about the latest issue of the paper, the Spring Anthology, Volume 1. More information is available online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.